are worldviews that seem to dominate the landscape. One of them, if you have a kid in public school, if you've looked in a textbook, if you've watched anything of a scientific nature on television, one of them is Darwinism. It appears to be so strong. I mean, everyone seems to take it for granted. And if you didn't watch the polls, you might believe that Darwinism was in fact a very popular worldview. Well, while it may be popular, at least in educational circles, there are surveys out that show that most people don't buy evolution or Darwinism's claims. We're going to talk about Darwinism. And are there other reasons we can look at Darwinism and say, as a worldview, it is a failed worldview? That's the subject for the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. We'll be talking about the claims that Darwinism makes and how it fails with Dr. Angus Manoj. In the second half hour, our good friend Wesley Smith joins us. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. There's a new Gallup poll on assisted suicide. Wesley has looked at it. He says perhaps the pendulum on assisted suicide legally and the way we think about it as a people is swinging around. That's the first hour of Issues Etc. The second hour, have you ever heard of Pelagianism? It's an ancient heresy in the church. It has to do with whether or not man cooperates in his salvation. We'll go into some detail in the second hour of Issues Etc. today with Dr. R. Scott Clark of Westminster Theological Seminary about Pelagianism and its kissing cousin, semi-Pelagianism. And in the third hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. Lots to talk about in the third hour. Of course, open lines is always about anything you'd like to talk about, too. Our phone numbers for these 3 hours of Issues Etc. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I sincerely hope that you and yours did have an enjoyable Memorial Day weekend. I certainly did. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, May the 27th. Dr. Angus Manoj is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Associate Director of the Cronach Institute at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Manoj will be making a presentation at a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar June the 20th through the 27th at the Schwann Center in Trago, Wisconsin. I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. His presentation is titled Darwinism's Failures. Dr. Manoj, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, thanks, Todd.
Let's begin with the claims of Darwinism. What are the basic claims of this particular worldview?
Basically, it says that the various species, including the human species, have originated by random mutations and a process of natural selection that weeds out those that are unfit and preserves those that are fit. And this process is said to be undirected. It's not aiming at any particular direction. And also gradual. It happens very slowly because, of course, it would be far too improbable for large changes to happen all at once. And along with that is a larger view called universal Darwinism that says that processes like this aren't just at work in biology, but also in cosmology and human psychology. That is, they explain the formation of the physical universe and even how human beings think. And the crucial dimension here is that it's held that God plays no role. The view is sometimes called methodological naturalism, that they think that in science you proceed as if there is no God, and God certainly has nothing to do in this particular theory.
So if there might be a Darwinist out there who says, look, I'm not an atheist, I'm an agnostic. God is just simply irrelevant to my view of where life came from, how the universe has evolved, how human beings evolve psychologically. Would that be an accurate picture there?
Yeah, right. There are many people like that, such as Kenneth Miller of Brown University, who will say, you know, Darwinism is just a science, that because they're methodological naturalists, they can still say that God exists. It's just that he isn't really involved in the process in any scientifically interesting way.
One of the things that I've found fascinating in talking about Darwinism on this program recently is to discover that Darwinism a la Darwin himself is not exactly what passes for Darwinism today. How has it changed in the past century or so?
Well, it's changed because Darwin himself didn't really have a mechanism that he had proposed. He simply thought that there was this descent with modification, and that explained the diversity of life. But he didn't know, he didn't have any idea what to say the process of modification was. Now, what happened in the 20th century was the suggestion that, well, perhaps it is this random change in this DNA, which is transmitted from parents to their offspring, and that somehow random change in that explains the different creatures and the different information that's found in different creatures' DNA.
Very recently in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Dr. Manoj, and I'm sure it appeared nationally in papers as well, there was a story about a academic at Wayne State University, one Morris Goodman, who is suggesting that human beings and chimpanzees belong in the same genus because they share a vast majority of their genetic pattern with one another. And he's really kind of advocating rewriting the rules for classifying species of animals. Is that just another part of the continuing evolution of Darwinism?
Well, one of the things here that's interesting is that they put so much stock in the idea that DNA are the sole determinants of development. And the fact is that there's lots of evidence that that is really not the case. Harvard geneticist Richard Lewontin has been saying this for decades and was very skeptical about the Human Genome Project because he was confident there are lots of other factors that shape who we are. And so, you know, if the story had been that it's changes in your DNA that make you who you are, then we ought to be very similar to monkeys. But obviously we're not because of all our cultural achievements, which monkeys don't enjoy.
So how does Darwinism as a worldview fail? In what respect does it fail?
Well, there's three dimensions I want to talk about a little bit. First of all, methodological. In its justification for saying you can't have God in science, it usually gives a God of the gaps argument where it says, well, if you bring in God, you're really just giving an argument from ignorance and saying, because we don't know why this occurs, therefore God did it. But actually, defenders of intelligent design point out that what makes design plausible is increased knowledge, not an argument from ignorance. Let me read this quote from Bruce Alberts, president of the National Academy of Sciences. He said, when looking at just one cell, that it can be viewed as a factory that contains an elaborate network of assembly lines, each of which is composed of a set of large protein machines. Why do we call them machines? Precisely because, like machines invented by humans to deal efficiently with the macroscopic world, these protein assemblies contain highly coordinated moving parts. And it's also said that it's a science stopper because if you say God did it, then what else is there to investigate? That's a bad argument because God can use means. God works through the means of ordinary reproduction to pass on DNA. Okay, that doesn't explain the origin of the information in that DNA. It's rather like with the doctrine of vocation. God can produce bread miraculously, as he did in the desert with manna, but normally he works through bakers and truck drivers and the like. So to say that there's evidence of divine design doesn't stop scientific investigation into whatever natural means may be going on. And the third argument that's often given is that, well, the divine is inscrutable. We can't really know what's going on. And it seems to me this is a major theological error because Romans 1 is very clear that the unbeliever is without excuse because God's qualities are revealed in nature. It's true you can't come to a personal relationship with God by these means, but you can, if you like, discern altars to an unknown God by science, and then that leaves it for theology to proclaim who that God is. And along with that, there are some other criticisms of Darwinism that many times it seems to be unfalsifiable. That's because when a particular explanation doesn't work, they can always say, well, it's some other natural process or some other pathway And the problem with that is you can say that indefinitely.
See, that this is where that unfalsifiable nature of evolution seems to turn Darwinism's critiques of religion back upon Darwinism itself, because you mentioned the God of the Gaps critique that the evolutionists will often make. Well, you're just trying to explain via God something that you don't yet understand, and yet they do this all the time.
They do, as Bill Dembski likes to say, a chance of the gaps. In other words, whenever they're in difficulty, they will appeal to a highly unlikely chance and say that that did it. But really, to say that you could say that that's really an argument from ignorance. And also, in our experience, there is a better case for design, because design is detectable. We do know that highly complex structures, such as Shakespeare's sonnets, do arise normally only from an intelligent mind. So this is an argument from knowledge, not an argument from ignorance. If we find things in biology which are at least as complicated as Shakespeare's sonnets, then that's good reason to think that some intelligence was involved in their production.
Now, you have mentioned here several times the intelligent design argument, which has really broken into the popular consciousness in about the last 2 years with books by William Dembski and others. Explain to us what intelligent design as an alternative to evolution proposes, and why isn't this just creationism in different garb?
Well, basically, it's a broad umbrella movement. It's not in any way trying to argue directly from the Bible. From a Lutheran point of view, it's rather congenial because it sticks to the left-hand kingdom of reason, just what the evidence is. And it's basically arguing that you can have rigorous empirical evidence of design. And one of the key points that Phil Johnson likes to make is it's a mistake to confuse empirical science and methodologically naturalist science. Methodologically naturalist science will only consider naturalistic explanations no matter what the evidence is. Empirical science will follow the evidence where it leads, and there's no guarantee that it will always give you a natural explanation. And Dembski and Del Ratch and some others have come up with some very interesting criteria that let you detect design in a thoroughly scientific way. It doesn't repeat the mistakes of natural theology, which perhaps sometimes went too far and claimed to identify the designer. Again, that's why I like the Acts 17 analogy. You can provide evidence, you can provide that altar that will tell you there was a God involved, but at the point where you identify the God, that is a matter of a special revelation, and that's where the Bible comes in.
So you're saying that intelligent design, as opposed to evolution, intelligent design says, look, we're simply following the evidence where it leads, even if it leads us to conclude that there is a designer.
Right.
And whereas evolution, being a purely naturalistic argument, says we really only allow evidence in favor of the naturalistic viewpoint.
That is correct. And that seems rather stultifying, because in practice, with human design, we don't do that. We recognize whether, if you're doing a forensic investigation, we distinguish between natural death, accidental death, and murder. Likewise with how you distinguish archaeological items from wind sculptures and the like, or with fraud investigation and those kinds of things. We use this inference all the time, and in fact, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is premised on the idea that there'd be a certain signature that you could get back that would tell you that there was intelligence in other planets.
The second area in which you say that Darwinism as a worldview fails is in terms of biology. Tell us about that.
Yeah, in the case of biology, Behe's done a wonderful job with this notion of an irreducibly complex system. He says that's a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. And as a toy example, his favorite example is the mouse trap that has to have a platform, a hammer, a spring, a catch, and a holding bar, five parts. Take away any one of those five, the mouse trap doesn't work. And the idea is that, well, the way that evolution is supposed to work is you always have to have something that works, and then perhaps you can modify and improve on it. But if you take away any one part of the mousetrap, it doesn't work. Well, in nature, it turns out there are lots of things that are like this, such as the blood clotting system, where you have to have something which starts a clot so you don't bleed to death, and yet also something to inhibit the clot so you don't get a stroke. Or the best example is the bacterial flagellum. This is sort of like an outboard motor system that bacteria have, and it's a very complicated structure involving a propeller and a motor and all kinds of specialized parts. And the challenge is, well, how can something like that develop gradually? Because you need all these parts here at once in order for it to function at all. Now, in response, the defenders of Darwinism have come up with three main ideas, and I can't go into full detail here, but the main ideas that they've said in response are, well, couldn't it be co-optation? If you have a mouse trap and take away a part, maybe it's good for a tie clip. Well, likewise, perhaps in biology, what you have is the simplest systems do some other function, and then you plug it into something else in to get a new item. The problem with that is that kind of scenario is only plausible if you have very generic building blocks, like the old style Legos that probably you and I used to play with. In biochemical systems, it turns out that many of the proteins have this hand-in-glove characteristic. They're very, very specific, and they have to be perfectly geometrically matching in order for them to bind together. And so, in fact, they're much more like the new Legos, like my kids play with, the Bionicles. The problem is that those parts are so specifically attuned and adapted to work with other parts that the chances that you're going to find a part lying around that will do that job that was doing some other function, it's like thinking you can take something from your lawnmower and put it in your Ferrari and expect it to do anything. So co-optation is actually very implausible when you look at the specificity and the finely tuned nature of these systems.
So it kind of goes back to, again, the contentions of intelligent design, or for that matter, the position that you and I share, and that is of the literal six-day creation by the triune God, that God has created things so that they function, and they are irreducibly complex as systems. If you take out my heart doesn't really have a function in and of itself apart from pumping blood through my body, and my body doesn't function without it.
Yeah, right. In other words, its function is defined relationally. There's not something for it to do by itself lying around. Its function is part of a holistic system, and it's so finely tuned to that function that it's really very implausible that it's just going to be lying around doing something else. And by the way, this tends to contradict their claim as well. They're saying the process is undirected. Well, if these things could form, then that would really be pre-adaptation, because look, oh, here's something. It has just the function we need for something in the future. Well, now you're bringing in prevision and goals and everything that Darwinism denies, and so that's really a contradictory move for them to make. And the other couple of moves they make. One is to say, well, maybe these systems aren't really irreducibly complex. Maybe there's some redundancy in them. There's this very clever fellow, John McDonald, who's shown that you can actually have 4 and 3 and 2, and even he claims one part mousetraps. And the way you do it is by adjusting these parts so that they can do the job sort of with fewer parts. Well, the problem is that if you take the three-part mouse trap, the way in which the parts are attuned to trap mice with just three parts means they're not in the right shape to do the job with four parts. Okay, it's so specific, the way they have to be tuned, that making it do the job with fewer parts means it's completely in the wrong position to help if you add further parts.
And not to mention the fact that we're not talking about mouse traps, but we are more likely talking here about things like cells in a body, which are not trying to function on their own independent of other cells, but will function in concert with many other systems.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good point to make, is that the challenge is really much, much greater, because it's not as if it's just a matter of having the heart alone, which is formidable enough, but having it in concert, as you say, with all these other systems around it. And so, you know, Mousetrap is really much too generous a concession to the Darwinists, really. And lastly, the other effort is scaffolding, which says, well, maybe there's a helper system, kind of like you have when you build an arch. It's lying around. You can build the arch. Once it's there, the scaffolding disappears. Well, of course, why does the scaffolding develop? If ultimately it's not really doing anything, then it wouldn't develop in the first place, according to their viewpoint. And if it is doing something, well, then if it's adapted to doing that, it's not going to be helpful in doing something else. So that view doesn't seem to work. It also, again, brings in goals, because the scaffolding is there for building something in the future. So I don't really think that those are at all convincing. And in fact, my work in computer science, what I've learned is that in problem solving, when problems get difficult, the only way to solve difficult problems manageably is a process called top-down design. But of course, that means you have to have a goal, you have to have a picture of where you're going before you design a solution, just like when you get the instructions to put together a bookcase or something like that. Well, the goal is there specified before you start putting together the bookcase.
Dr. Manouz, could you stay with us for a few minutes after the
break? Sure.
Finally, we've got about a minute here before we need to go to this break. Very briefly, and we'll continue a little bit on the other side of the break, you say that Darwinism as a worldview also fails psychologically. You have about 1 minute before we need to go.
All right. The main argument is that it really predicts that our minds would be unreliable. C.S. Lewis made this argument. So's Alvin Plantinger of Notre Dame University. There's really no need for the content of our thoughts to have anything to do with our behavior, because all that is going to get selected, according to natural selection, is useful responses. You can have useful responses and have hideously false and unreliable beliefs. And so, if that's the case, and our beliefs are terribly unreliable, then we shouldn't have any confidence in anything, really, including evolutionary naturalism. So if the theory is true, then necessarily there can't be good reason to believe it. And that seems like a jolly good reason to throw it out in the first place, because surely we're not as at sea as all that.
Dr. Angus Manouz is our guest. He'll continue with us for just a few minutes on the other side of this break. We'll then be joined by Wesley Smith to talk about the pendulum of popular approval on euthanasia. Dr. Angus Manouz is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Associate Director of the Cranach Institute at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. He'll be making a presentation at a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar June the 20th through the 27th at the Schwann Center in Trago, Wisconsin. I'll tell you about that seminar after this break. His presentation is titled Darwinism's Failures. We'll conclude our conversation with him right after this. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When you look at Darwinism simply in these terms, does it stack up? Does it function by its own rules? Is it logical, the way it approaches problems? It seems to be an outright failure. We'll be right back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are you looking for a vacation this summer where you can relax, renew, and refocus? Well, I have just the opportunity for you. It's a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th at the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin. It's about 2 hours from Minneapolis. Not only will you have the chance to relax in the beauty and serenity of the picturesque Namekagon River, two private lakes, miles of hiking trails, and abundant wildlife, but you'll also have the opportunity to refocus and renew by listening to instruction from Issues Etc. regular guests Craig Parton, George Mather, Angus Manouz, and Rolf Preuss. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call the Schwann Center at 1-800-577-4848. Ask for information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June 20th through the 27th in northern Wisconsin, 1-800-577-4848.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Muslims in Macedonia. Christians in the Eastern European country of Albania continue praying for Muslims living in the neighboring country of Macedonia. A Christian organization reports that one goal of the prayer movement is seeing new church planters rise up. Just more than 2 million people live in Macedonia, which has a lot of spiritual needs, according to the Missions Handbook Operation World. About 63% of the people say they're Christians, with the majority belonging to the Orthodox denomination. However, regular church attendance among Orthodox Christians is extremely low. Meanwhile, about 25% of the people are Muslims, and many originally came from Albania as refugees. There are also Muslims originally from Turkey and a smaller group called the Torbish, who have no outreach among them. Pray for Christ to be glorified in Macedonia. Pray for spiritual needs worldwide by logging on to the internet site missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Back to work after the holiday? Several of my friends were laid off recently. In July, American Airlines will be laying off over 3,100 flight attendants. When you've been laid off, you obviously face problems, and some are spiritual. You are tempted to become angry and bitter at your former boss. And if the boss is Christian, you are tempted to label him a hypocritical Christian. Whether a smart move or not, the boss had the right. That's the law, the requirement side, the expectation side of life in this world. The gospel of Jesus' forgiveness and hope does not prevent layoffs, but can help you cope. The inspiration he gives leads you to avoid bitterness, although bitterness is obviously quite inviting at the time. To respect the boss's right to lay you off, but still be kindly minded, that's not easy. But you will be better off for it. Let those also who suffer according to the will of God entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. 1 Peter 4:19. So, remember, your faith is in God more than in people.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AMA 50 KFUO underwriter.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're wrapping up our conversation with Dr. Angus Manoogian on Darwinism, and Wesley Smith will be joining us here in just a moment to talk about a new Gallup poll on assisted suicide. Dr. Manoogian, we've talked at some length here about the failures of Darwinism, and it's hard for me to believe that those devoted to this worldview and this way of thinking haven't noticed some of these things. Are there some more honest souls within the world of Darwinism who have recognized its failures and are willing to at least admit that it is not the ironclad theory or fact that so many claim it is?
Yes, there are, and to the extent that quite a few of them are spending a lot of time trying to respond to people like Behe and Dembski and other proponents of design. And on the one hand, the official rhetoric is that everything's under control, we know what's going on, because that's necessary to keep the status quo in education. But the fact is that reams and reams of articles or papers are being written to try and show that they can overcome the objections. And so I think that the actions speak a lot louder than the words.
How would you summarize to someone who has come through either a parochial or a public education, been taught Darwinism as more or less fact, and who says, look, I understand that there's some serious problems with it, but for heaven's sakes, isn't it the best we have, at least as far as scientific theories go? How would you respond to that person?
I'd say that if they have the background, they should read Dembski's No Free Lunch, because in there they will see some very powerful arguments to show that there are inherent limitations in the Darwinian process and things that they can't explain. They can't explain what he calls complex specified information, which is the kind of information that you see in biological structures. So that it's what I suggest to them is it's time for them to reconsider the implications of the information age and to see that there are certain things that these low-level random processes really can't explain, and we've gotten to the point that it is possible to prove that rather rigorously. And also to read books like Nature, Design, and Science by Del Ratch, who disposes of many of the objections to bringing in the supernatural in design. At a more popular level, The Wedge of Truth or The Right Questions by Phil Johnson are very good. And just to open up their mind to these possibilities.
Dr. Angus Manoj, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Okay, thank you, Todd.
Dr. Angus Manoj is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Associate Director of the Cronach Institute at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Manoj is going to be making a presentation at this Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th, at the Schwann Center in Trago, Wisconsin. Now, his presentation is going to deal, one of them will deal with Darwinism's failure. He'll also be there speaking the next day on the 24th of June about postmodernism and hyper-secularism. In addition to Dr. Manoj, some other regular guests here on Issues, Etc. will be at this conference presenting on a number of subjects. Let's see who else will be here. Talking about Catholicism today, Pastor Rolf Preuss will be there. Pastor George Mather will discuss Islam, and we'll be talking with Professor Craig Parton as well, as we broadcast live from the seminar in Trago, Wisconsin, June the 20th through the 27th. Now, for a very modest registration fee, you not only receive the seminar, but 7 nights lodging and all your meals. For more information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar in Trago, Wisconsin, June the 20th through the 27th, at the Schwann Conference and Retreat Center, you can call them 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. And under the What's New section, you'll find information on this seminar. Wesley Smith joins us for the remainder of this hour. We're going to talk about a new Gallup poll on assisted suicide. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of a recent column for National Review Online titled Dying Cause, Assisted Suicide is Losing Support. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. What does the latest polling data tell us about popular support for assisted suicide?
Well, it was really good news, and it's not the first poll of this kind, by the way, but the Gallup organization found that today 49% of those polled by Gallup view physician-assisted suicide as morally wrong, while only 45% considered it acceptable. So it's about a 50-50 split when you consider the margin of error, and that some in that poll apparently found that it would depend on the circumstances. This is a tremendous improvement from the polls that showed just a few years ago 70% accepting assisted suicide, or 65%. And my own sense, I've been fighting assisted suicide for 10 years now, my own sense of this is goes along with this. Back when Oregon legalized assisted suicide in 1994, it seemed like that the death juggernaut would literally sweep the nation. But slowly and surely, that horrible pendulum swing has begun to come back. And it would appear now that we have reached a point of near parity, and that's a tremendous cause for celebration. It doesn't mean the danger's over, of course. Assisted suicide could break through again at any time, like it almost did last year in Hawaii. But we're on much better ground now than we were even 3 or 4 years ago.
What has changed? What has changed the direction of this pendulum?
Well, it could be many things. You know, this is just Smith on how this stuff works, the cultural zeitgeist. I think 9/11 may have had something to do with it. We see the importance of human life from that tragedy. If you take a look at the Kevorkian debacle, where he was this great big hero, and then it turns out that 70% of the people that he assisted in suicide were not terminally ill, 5 weren't even sick upon their autopsies, and you take a look at some of the radicals in the movement, like Philip Nitschke of Australia, who wants a suicide pill, as we've discussed on this program, Todd, available to troubled teenagers in supermarkets. So people, I think, begin to look at these very obsessed folks, the people in the euthanasia movement, people like Derek Humphrey, who invents suicide machines, and they begin to look at the needs of people, the needs for spiritual succor when they're under terrible extremists, such as if they're dying or disabled, the need to have pain controlled and so forth, and potentially the problems of healthcare resource problems when you consider assisted suicide as a potential medical treatment. What could be cheaper than killing if that ever became a legitimized treatment? I think people are beginning to look at the reality as opposed to the idealized vision, not to mention also what's going on in the Netherlands, which we can talk about, and they're saying, wait a second, this doesn't work.
Now, you mentioned early on in your column for National Review Online that the boilerplate criticism of those who would oppose assisted suicide from those who are in favor of it has been, well, look, no one but a religious zealot, namely, more often than not, a Roman Catholic religious zealot, would be opposed to this kind of compassionate measure taken on the part of the terminally ill. You say that just doesn't hold any water anymore. Why so?
Well, what's happened since Oregon, and it really came to a head in Oregon, that the people who pushed to pass what was called Measure 16, which legalized assisted suicide, basically ran an explicitly anti-Catholic campaign. It's really shocking if you take a look at some of the ads, in which they accused opponents of being theologically driven, and that the theology was that those who opposed assisted suicide thought that there was tremendous redemption in suffering, so nothing should be done to alleviate suffering, which of course is just malarkey. I mean, I'm not Catholic, but that's certainly not the Catholic view of things. But what's happened since then is, and in a sense because of what happened with Kevorkian and how for many years he was able to assist the suicides of depressed, disabled people and get applauded by the general society, that brought in the assisted suicide, the disability rights activists in opposition to assisted suicide because they saw themselves as the targets. So, you know, when you say that this is all about religion, well, disability rights activists tend not to be religious. They tend to be secularist. Of course, there are exceptions to that. And they're not even conservative. Most disability rights activists tend to be very liberal. And many of them are not pro-life. So this idea that it was all this small group of medieval religionists stopping modernity basically was stopped in its tracks when the disability rights activists began to act in an alliance, a strange political bedfellow alliance with medical professionals who are not religionists in their approach, hospice professionals, advocates for the poor, some of them on the very far left of things, as well as Catholics and traditional pro-lifers.
Does this point the way to a certain degree, Wesley, for people like yourselves to say, look, we need to take our alliances where we can get them when it comes to opposing assisted suicide and euthanasia?
Well, that's been what I've been doing for 10 years. I've tried to serve as a bridge between people who are pro-life, for example. I speak often in front of pro-life groups, and I'm very happy to do so, and people who are not pro-life, and I speak in front of disability rights groups and medical professional groups and legal continuing education groups and so forth. I think it's not only the way to stop assisted suicide, because it has stopped assisted suicide in this country since Oregon, but it is the way to stop human cloning. It is the way to stop other agendas that threaten the sanctity of human life.
You mentioned before, I'd like you to elaborate on this, because this is one of the more bone-chilling aspects of assisted suicide, and that has to do with the bottom line for health maintenance organizations. Tell us about that.
Well, right now, you know, a lot of what used to drive assisted suicide when I first got into this activity, I'd go to give a speech, and I'd say, how many of you in the audience, and there might be hundreds of people in the audience, how many of you are afraid of being hooked up to a machine against your will when you're dying, and all you want to be able to do is go home and die a natural death in your bed surrounded by your loved ones? And 10 years ago, and 9 and 8 years ago, when I was asking that question, almost every hand would go up. Today, if I ask that question, very few hands go up. Why the change? The change is people now know that money in medicine is not made by providing services in the old fee-for-service system. It used to be that if somebody was in an intensive care unit, a lot of money was made off that patient. The hospital would make a profit off that patient because of the cost of intensive care. Doctors going in and consulting would charge a consult fee every time they checked in on the patient and so forth. But now we have HMOs and managed care and capitated payments, meaning a hospital gets a lump sum payment for whatever services, for example, under Medicare, the diagnosis-related group. They'll only get a one lump sum payment for the patient, and if that patient is more expensive to care for, then they lose money than if not. Doctors no longer necessarily get those kinds of fees for going in and consulting the way they once did. And in managed care, HMOs, profits come from cutting costs rather than providing services. So people are beginning to understand that they no longer have as much of a problem being hooked up to machines as they once did. They now have the problem of getting the kind of quality care that they used to take for granted based on financial issues. And then you take the assisted suicide issue and you plug it into that system. It only costs about $40 for the drugs it would take to assist somebody's suicide. It might cost $40,000 to provide the kind of treatment and support for a patient so they don't want to commit assisted suicide. Once that sank into people's heads and they started to think about the forces of financial gravity, the potential hazards of assisted suicide in the kind of health care system that we have in the United States became quite obvious.
Wesley Smith is our guest. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia Assisted Suicide. And he's also written a recent column in National Review Online, one among many, titled Dying Cause Assisted Suicide is Losing Support. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. On the line of the HMOs, we talked about this some time back, but the story had something to do with Kaiser Permanente and a memo that was passed back and forth between doctors and volunteers on the issue of suicide under its plans. What was that story?
Well, this was not all Kaiser Permanente's. This was Kaiser Permanente Northwest, the Kaiser Permanente that is in Oregon, where assisted suicide is legal. And what happened was Physicians for Compassionate Care, which is a group of medical professionals in Oregon who are dedicated to opposing assisted suicide, and work with a lot of doctors in that state who really are against this agenda, had leaked to them a memo from a Kaiser administrator asking doctors to please step forward and be willing to assist the suicides of plan members, and further stating that they were looking for doctors who would be willing to assist the suicides of plan members who weren't even their patients. Well, this is huge when you consider the potential conflicts of interest here. Now, there haven't been enough assisted suicides in Oregon to impact any bottom line, but when you have an HMO coming out saying, we want doctors to volunteer to do this, even if the person asking for assisted suicide isn't it the actual patient of the doctor, that's big. And there was another situation in which Kate Cheney in Oregon, this was reported by the Oregonian, had Alzheimer's disease when she was asking for assisted suicide, and the newspaper report demonstrated that the real agenda, or at least the big powerful moving force behind this, was the daughter. And despite this, and despite the woman's problems even remembering how long she'd been terminally ill, a HMO administrator for Kaiser, after receiving two conflicting psychiatric evaluations, one saying, don't do it, she doesn't understand it, the other one saying, well, there are some memory problems and certainly there are family pressures, but you can go ahead. The Kaiser administrator made the final decision to go ahead with that. So the two HMO examples that have come out in Oregon, because it's all practiced assisted suicide under deepest, darkest secrecy there, have had to do with Kaiser. Interestingly, Todd, since my article came out and I brought those points up, I heard from a very famous bioethicist, who I will not name because it was a private correspondent, who took me to task for this HMO perspective. And this person mentioned that he is a has been on the ethics committee for HMOs.
Oh, that's encouraging.
So, you know, here he is telling me to stop bringing this up because there aren't any abuses, you know, and he's on an ethics committee for an HMO. So at least we're getting their attention.
Do you have any sense about where the HMOs or their lobbying organizations are with regard to the assisted suicide issue legislatively?
They stay silent because they know if they came out in favor of it, that it would be huge in terms of the political firestorm. But what I would like to see some HMOs do, it would be very interesting, wouldn't it? They claim that this idea of that assisted suicide could be used to save money is bogus. There's one way to prove it. In fact, I urge every HMO to come out and say, we will not provide assisted suicide to our plan members, even if it ever becomes legal. And I urge Oregon HMOs to say, we are no longer making that part of our provision of services. Because, you know, in Oregon, a patient does not have a right to assisted suicide. They have a right to ask for it, but doctors have the right to say no. So if no HMO is required to provide assisted suicide in Oregon. In fact, the Catholic HMOs do not in Oregon. So if HMOs are really saying that all of what I'm writing about in terms of the financial potential conflicts of interest here are bogus, there's one way to prove it. Say no to assisted suicide and put plaques in your offices saying this is a euthanasia-free zone.
You mentioned also before that euthanasia advocates have suffered from time to time at the hand of their own enthusiasm, or in the case of Jack Kevorkian or Nitsky, something far beyond enthusiasm, perhaps even obsession. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, if anybody pays any close attention to the assisted suicide movement, you will see obsessed people whose real underlying fear is of dying, and who think they somehow gain control of death by controlling what the term is, the time and manner. And that's why they call it the ultimate civil right. So you see, the Hemlock Society, as we've discussed before, the Hemlock Society being the nation's largest assisted suicide advocacy group, paying Philip Nitsky, the Australian Kevorkian, tens of thousands of dollars to develop this peaceful pill, this suicide concoction made of normal household ingredients, even though he says he wants that peaceful pill available for troubled teens and to anybody who wants it, including available for sale in the supermarket. You will see assisted suicide advocates oohing and aahing at conventions over various assisted suicide contraptions, such as the debreather, which takes oxygen. It's like a gas mask, only instead of providing oxygen, it takes it out. You see how to commit suicide seminars being run. You've seen how to commit suicide seminars even on cable access television in Oregon and in Hawaii, run by Derek Humphrey, the founder of the Hemlock Society. If you take a look at the obsessive quality of the Hemlock Society literature in terms of how many of their members commit suicide under the Caring Friends program, they call it, under the Hemlock Society, and what methods did they use? It becomes unfortunately, a Heaven's Gate cult in slow motion. It's very sad. I think a classic example is I was once introduced to a woman from Hemlock Society who knew who I was and the work I do. She was very nice, and she said, Mr. Smith, how do you envision your death? And I had to say, Todd, I said, ma'am, I'm sorry. I'm working on envisioning my life. We have to worry about people who get so caught up in the potential for suffering, and even worse, the idea that somehow people become burdens when they go through dying, which is a natural process just like giving birth is, that we have to overcome that attitude and realize and reach out to people in hospice and with palliative care and with when our friends are in trouble with health, that nobody is expendable. We're all in this together.
We've got just a minute. You wanted to mention something about what's going on in the Netherlands, about a minute and a half before we've got to go, Wesley.
Well, if you look at the euthanasia in the Netherlands over the last 30 years, they've gone from killing terminally ill people who ask for it to chronically ill people who ask for it, to depressed people who aren't physically ill who ask for it. You can they kill babies born with birth defects. I mean, once you decide that killing is an answer to a human problem, for one problem, e.g. dying, then it becomes an answer quickly to 100 problems, because you have broken through an important constraint that says thou shalt not kill. Once you get into killing as an answer to human difficulties, other than things like self-defense, then you've opened a Pandora's box that can never be put back together. And now in the Netherlands, not only have they legalized euthanasia, but the Minister of Health has said, within days of that happening, that for old people who are tired of life, who don't qualify for euthanasia, we should give them suicide pills. It's just an astonishing abandonment of people who may need the love of their fellows more than ever at a crucial time.
With only 30 seconds, how far will the pendulum swing? It's coming back in against euthanasia. How far do you expect it to swing?
Well, I expect it to be a long-term low-grade fever. And we're going to have to ever be vigilant and alert, because you're always going to have 35, 40, 45% of the people in this country who are willing to accept assisted suicide euthanasia. And that means any time it can have a breakthrough. And if there's another big breakthrough, such as Hawaii, then suddenly the winds of death are blowing again, and we're back to the pendulum swinging in the wrong direction.
Wesley Smith, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and he's author of a recent column for National Review Online titled Dying Cause, Assisted Suicide is Losing Support. You can also read this column at Wesley's website, wesleyjsmith.com. That's wesleyjsmith.com, as well as several other articles and columns by Wesley on this subject and others. When we come back from this break, Pelagianism, what in the world is it? And its kissing cousin, semi-Pelagianism. Now, you may have a vague idea that it has something to do with how a man is saved. We'll find out about this ancient heresy, how it is still with us today, and oddly, how it sometimes, although it's got the big fancy label, goes unlabeled, sometimes even passes, for the mainstream of Christian teaching today. Dr. R. Scott Clark will join us after the break. He's from Westminster Theological Seminary. If you'd like to join us for that hour and the hour of open lines that follows, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.